Welcome to today's Lunch and Law event on the topic, the bump stock ban, administrative overreach, or valid measure. We are pleased to feature three knowledgeable panelists who have been deeply involved in pending litigation over the bump stock type devices final rule issued by the Department of Justice and the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, Firearms, and Explosives. First, we welcome Eric Jaffe, a partner with Sher Jaffe Law Firm here in D.C. Eric clerked for Justice Thomas at the U.S. Supreme Court, was in solo practice here for two decades before joining Sher Jaffe, and is a well-regarded appellate litigator in town. He represents the plaintiffs in the case currently pending at the U.S. Court of Appeals for the District of Columbia Circuit. Next, we welcome Adam Skaggs, Chief Counsel of the Giffords Law Center. Adam's group filed an amicus brief in support of the final rule in the D.C. Circuit case. He was a litigation associate at Paul Weiss in New York City and clerked for Judge Stanley Marcus on the 11th Circuit before that. Last but not least, today's moderator is NCLA's own Caleb Kruckenberg. Caleb came to NCLA from the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers. Before that, he was a federal public defender and began his career in the Appeals Bureau of the New York County District Attorney's Office. Caleb has been leading NCLA's efforts in the litigation over the bump stock ban and doing a very good job, I should say. As he would be the first to tell you, NCLA's case is not about the wisdom of the policy banning bump stocks. Rather, it is about whether ATF can ban them without Congress. Without further ado, take it away, Caleb.
Thanks, Mark. To start our discussion, I've asked each of our panelists to present a different part of their perspective on the bump stock rule. And I want to start the discussion with Eric. And I've asked Eric to explain what the bump stock rule is and what it's trying to do and why, in his view, the regulation effectively rewrites the statute.
Thank you. Well, I think from my perspective, what the bump stock rule does, and I confess to at least in part agreeing with the Department of Justice on this, is it's a declaratory rule. It says this is how we read the statutory language. And whether that current reading of the statutory language changes what that language has traditionally been understood to mean is certainly the issue about whether it changes the law. But as a practical matter, they're asserting a far more modest thing. They're asserting that this is what these words mean. There's a statute that says a machine gun is X, Y, and Z. And they say, we just read the words X, Y, and Z and think they mean this. It's a very straightforward interpretive process that people do all the time. The trouble, of course, is that for 85 years, they said, we think X means X, Y means Y, and Z means Z. And as of the moment that President Trump called us up, we now think X means X prime, and Y means Y prime, and Z means Z prime. All of those folks who told you it really meant X, they didn't really think about it very hard, and they didn't know what they were talking about. That, to me, is, in a nutshell, what this is about. They have taken an earlier understanding by ATF itself and by Treasury before them that this is what a trigger is, this is what a single function of the trigger is, this is what the word automatically means. And they said, actually, we're going to use a different reading of those words, such that they're broad enough to then capture additional things that weren't captured before. Bump stocks being the particular example they give, but not, of course, the only example, because the regulation doesn't just say bump stocks are covered. The regulation says automatically means this, and single function of the trigger means that, and by the way, when you put those together, one result, but hardly the only result, is bump stocks are covered. And for me, the bump stocks are covered piece of this is like the tail of the dog. The dog is, you've changed the definition, and it covers lots of things, not just bump stocks. And as a consequence, we have taken the position that it is overbroad, that it's the wrong reading, that the traditional reading is more accurate, and that Congress has, in fact, effectively adopted some of the older interpretations of this language in subsequent legislation. But for the moment, just so that everyone understands where these cases are at, or at least where my case is at, in the D.C. Circuit, the question is not, is the government, do they have the better interpretation, or do we have the better interpretation? The only real question is whether the government's interpretation is the clear interpretation of the statute. To the extent that there is any meaningful uncertainty after applying traditional rules of judicial interpretation, any meaningful remaining uncertainty, there's a standard rule, a canon of construction that says on criminal laws, it's a rule of lenity, where we're lenient towards people who might otherwise be accused of being criminals. If there's ambiguity, the rule of lenity requires you to take the narrower construction of the crime rather than the broader construction of the crime. And so I applaud the government in some ways for eschewing reliance on Chevron, for example. So lower courts in a variety of these cases have said, well, the government's interpretation is reasonable, so we give them deference, we adopt that interpretation. But actually the government has said, no, don't give us that. We don't want it. We didn't ask for it. It's probably wrong, though they haven't fully committed to that yet. But they've certainly, the first two, we don't want it, we didn't ask for it, they have fully committed to. And in some pleadings, they've arguably said it would be wrong too. But leave that aside. So I give them kudos for being straightforward about that and not relying on an extremely dubious source of this ruling, and in fact, sort of rejecting the rationale of some of the lower courts. But taking the stronger position that says, we think we're right. We don't need deference. We think we're actually right, that this is what this language means. And that's a perfectly reasonable legal fight to have. The only trouble is, of course, that they're completely wrong. They're not even close to being right. It's so laughable that they would suggest that this is the clear reading of the statute. I understand that it is a reading of the statute, and possibly, if you were being generous, a plausible reading of the statute. But the notion that it is the only reading of the statute, much less the best reading of the statute, you would have to say that 85 years worth of ATF attorneys, up to and including the general counsel in the weeks following the Las Vegas shooting, were idiots because they couldn't actually read clear language. They were incapable of having the ordinary understanding of an average citizen about what words meant. Look, maybe the ATF employs idiots. I'm the last one to suggest that. But it's possible. But for 85 years, they had a continuous run of stupid people? That's hard to imagine. So that's sort of how I view this case, that at the end of the day, it's less a fight about can an agency make up brand new law that criminalizes things. I think even the government concedes they can't do that. So I think effectively that's what they may be doing. But nobody asserts that power affirmatively. And then we get to fight about what words mean and what a change in position by an agency means and how that reflects upon the meaning of congressionally enacted language. And all of the rest of it is just sideshow detail. Does it shoot fast? Does it shoot slow? Is it really automatic? Is it sort of automatic? How much input can you have? How much input does the machine have to make it automatic? What's one function of the trigger versus two functions of the trigger? All of that, it's good, it's important, we're going to have to fight about that at the end of the day, but just to understand, it has little or no bearing on the actual outcome of the case, or should have little or no bearing on the actual outcome of the case, because that's not the question. The question is the language plain? And if the language is not plain, we know the answer, regardless of whether the government has a plausible interpretation of that language. It's just not the only interpretation of that language. It's probably not even the most likely public understanding of that language, given that the government itself has gone the other way.
Erica, if we could just back up one second, I'm just curious if you could explain, because we have kind of the context here, I'm curious if you could just explain what the statute does and what a machine gun is that's prohibited and what the rule is doing.
The first thing the statute does is define what is a machine gun. And it says a machine gun is any firearm that shoots, comma, automatically without manual reloading, comma, more than one shot with a single function of the trigger. That's what the definition says. So shoots automatically, more than one shot, single function of the trigger. The manual reloading part is interesting sometimes, but not here, because we're talking semi-automatic weapons, all of which automatically reload the next bullet. So sometimes it might matter. Here it doesn't. That's what the statute says. And traditionally, we've understood that to mean a gun where you take your finger, you pull the trigger, you hold it, and it goes and keeps shooting. You let go, it stops shooting. You hold it, it keeps shooting. That's what we've traditionally understood a machine gun to be. a semi-automatic weapon, you take your finger, you pull it, it goes boom. Nothing happens after that. You let go, you pull it again, it goes boom, shoots another shot. It's very simple, very straightforward. The government has said, we have a different view of this. We have a view that says, any action that initiates a cycle of repetitive shots in a self-regulating manner is a machine gun. So if I do this, even if I have to let go of the finger, even if the trigger mechanism itself moves back and forth, it was still something, it was the initial pull that goes boom, that causes recoil, let's say, or whatever, it causes other things to happen that cause the next trigger pull, and the next trigger pull, and the next trigger pull, which they interpret as a process initiated by the first trigger pull, even if it later involves subsequent trigger pulls. And that's really the fight. So they've redefined the word automatically to mean by a self-acting or self-regulating mechanism, and the self-acting part is not meaningful. It's the self-regulating part that's actually meaningful. And single pull, single function of the trigger, they say, is a single pull of the trigger. So focusing on the action of the shooter, pulling, versus the action of the mechanism, the trigger, function of the trigger, it's a function of the shooter for all practical purposes. It's what you do, not what the machine does, that the government has shifted slightly the focus on. And that has expanded it to cover things that wouldn't have been covered before, like bump stocks, electric-driven Gatling guns, for example, which in the 50s were deemed to be not covered, but in 2004, 2006, I think it was, were functionally deemed to be covered in the minigun ruling. So there's some subtle shifts that, while seemingly small and quibbling about words, drag in lots of other devices, including, in my view, though perhaps we'll have a good chat about this, I think any semi-automatic weapon is covered by this new rule. I think there's no way to exclude ordinary semi-automatic weapons based on the government's construction of this rule. And that's really what's at stake, is the definition, not the bump stock piece. The bump stock piece is just an example, but it's the definition that matters.
Thanks, Eric. Now, I want to turn my focus here to the political background of the bump stock rule. And, you know, we've been very clear as an organization, New Civil Liberties Alliance, that, you know, our objection here is not about bump stocks, whether they should be regulated or not, but our objection is really one to the process. And so I want to talk about how this final rule came about and just kind of give the background, because, you know, in our view, it's very informative. On March 23rd of 2018, the bump stock rule was, that was the day the bump stock rule was formally announced, Senator Dianne Feinstein issued the following statement. Quote, "Until today, the ATF has consistently stated that bump stocks cannot be banned through regulation because they do not fall under the legal definition of a machine gun. And now the department has done an about-face, claiming that bump stocks do fall under the legal definition of a machine gun, and it can ban them through regulations. The fact that ATF said as recently as April 2017 that it lacks this authority gives the gun lobby and its allies even more reason to file a lawsuit to block the regulations. Unbelievably, the regulation hinges on a dubious analysis claiming that bumping the trigger is not the same as pulling it. Both Justice Department and ATF lawyers know that legislation is the only way to ban bump stocks." And NCLA's position is, of course, that Senator Feinstein was correct as a matter of legal interpretation. But her concerns capture really the impropriety of what the ATF is doing and our main concerns with the process. By way of background, the ATF has addressed bump stocks since at least 2006. And the ATF first issued a letter ruling in 2006 describing what they called bump fire and bump stocks. And they described this bump fire as a vernacular term used in the firearms culture. And this was essentially something where someone just bumps the trigger of the semi-automatic firearm rapidly in order to mimic automatic fire or rapid fire. Bump stocks are a way that facilitates bump fire. And as early as 2010, the ATF addressed the slide fire bump stock, which is probably the most popular version. And the ATF said in a letter ruling that the slide fire was not a machine gun, it's not a regulated firearm, because a slide fire bump stock essentially doesn't do anything. It has no mechanical action, and it simply facilitates someone pulling a trigger multiple times. And so when Eric talks about the single function of the trigger, the ATF's view was, even if you can shoot rapidly, you're still pulling the trigger every time you fire a bullet, and therefore it is not a machine gun. And I'll note, you know, this is 2010 that we're having this conversation. And then in 2013, Congress, actually Representative Ed Perlmutter contacted the ATF and said, and requested clarification. And he said he wanted to see if the ATF's position still under the Obama administration was that bump stocks were not machine guns. And the ATF wrote a letter to Representative Perlmutter, and they said, I think confirmed again, that ATF noted that bump stocks do not fall within the classification for firearms contained in federal law. And they said, quote, ATF does not have the authority to restrict their lawful possession, use, or transfer. But of course, we all know what happened in October 2017 after the Las Vegas shooting, and that's when the tide turned. And even though the Obama administration had been very clear that they did not believe that bump stock could be regulated under existing law, the political tides shifted, and there became a lot of pressure on Congress to do something, on everybody to do something. But notably, even in October of 2017, immediately after the shooting in Las Vegas, ATF Director Brandon reaffirmed the agency's position, and he said that it was the then current ATF position that bump stocks could not be regulated under federal law. And as a result, Congress proposed at least five different pieces of legislation to address the problem. And these were bipartisan efforts. Republicans Brian Fitzpatrick in the House and Senator Jeff Flake both introduced proposals to prospectively restrict the sale of bump stocks. And notably, many of these legislative efforts focused on things like firing rate, because they decided that if a bump stock couldn't be regulated as a machine gun under existing law, then the appropriate stance was to regulate bump stocks as something that could facilitate rapid fire, because that was viewed as a more dangerous form of firing. But then in 2018, President Trump attempted to short-circuit the process, and he issued an executive order directing the ATF to propose the final rule. And the timing is very interesting, because on March 14th of 2018, the Senate Judiciary Committee held a hearing on one of Senator Feinstein's, on one of the bump stock bills, this one proposed by Senator Feinstein, and ATF Director Brandon testified at that hearing. And he sort of he previewed the agency's new view on bump stocks. And he said, essentially, that while he still believed that legislation was an appropriate, was probably the best way to address the issue, the ATF had essentially been overruled by the DOJ. And he said that even though the consensus within the agency for years and with the lawyers and experts at the ATF was that bump stocks could not be regulated, they had reevaluated their position based on input from the DOJ, obviously at the president's insistence, and that's why the final rule was proposed. And we think it's very telling that immediately after the final rule was issued in the Federal Register, all five legislative efforts stopped. None of those bills ever went to a vote, even in a committee, and none were advanced to the floor. And essentially, the ATF decided, with its change view, to short-circuit the legislative process and adopt this new interpretation of the existing rule. Now, in our perspective, this is profoundly concerning from a constitutional perspective. Because if we accept the premise, and obviously there are different views of this, but if we accept the premise that the final rule actually does alter the statutory language, and this is what the ATF has said for a long time, then we have a profound constitutional problem. Lawmaking is supposed to be from Congress, not the ATF. And laws can only be passed if they go through both houses and are presented to the president. But there's a much more important functional reason for those protections in the Constitution, and that's about democratic accountability. You know, here we have a very controversial issue, and it is one that comes with a lot of baggage for lawmakers. And so instead of having to make a very difficult decision and pass these bump stock bills, the ATF has taken that difficult political decision away from lawmakers and said, we will make that for you. But the ATF is not a politically accountable entity. We can't vote the ATF director out of office the same way we could our legislators. And not only does that take away our democratic power, but in our view, that makes legislators more likely to abdicate their role and say, we're not going to make the tough choices anymore. Why would I stick my neck out and ban bump stocks or not vote against a bill when the ATF can do it for me and I don't have to make that tough choice? And so in NCLA's view, you know, regardless of the policy merits, that is our concern. We're concerned about the process. And in this case, you couldn't really ask for a clearer example of an agency trying to take over Congress's role and say that they know better. And now that, you know, we've presented our perspective, Eric and I want to talk with Adam, and thank you for coming to speak with us. You know, Adam obviously has a different position, and your group, the Giffords Law Center, wrote an amicus brief upholding or requesting that the D.C. Circuit uphold the final rule. And so I'm asking, Adam, if you could talk to both of those points that we've talked about. First of all, just about, you know, our contention that there is a statutory conflict between the final rule and the definition of a machine gun, but also about the political process behind the rule.
Sure. Well, thanks for the introduction, and thanks for the invitation to join this conversation today. I'll try at least to address those two questions. And certainly it is true, we have taken the opposite position in the litigation. We've urged the D.C. Circuit to uphold the rule. But in some ways, while there are many issues and aspects of this case and this litigation on which we do take an opposite side from the other folks here at today's event, there's actually some areas, I think, where we find common agreement. And I want to sort of talk a little bit about both of those. So first, the first point of difference, I suppose, you know, we've heard, I think, very clearly that NCLA's position in this litigation is not driven by a view one way or the other on gun policy, but is really purely, or at least primarily, a process question. You know, who should be making the decision-making, not whether the decision at issue here is a smart one. You know, my organization is very much coming at this not from the perspective of, not from that same perspective. This is a gun issue for us. This is what led us to be concerned about bump stocks, the threat to public safety that they pose, as I would submit very clearly established in the Las Vegas massacre, because our organization focuses on gun safety and gun policy. You know, my organization, Giffords Law Center, was formed 26 years ago after a mass shooting in a San Francisco law firm perpetrated by a disgruntled client who came in and killed many folks working at their desks at the law firm and injured many more. And we were renamed Giffords Law Center a couple of years ago after we teamed up with the gun safety organization led by former Congresswoman Gabrielle Giffords, who of course was shot in January several years ago, in 8 years ago in Tucson, while meeting with her constituents. So Giffords Law Center is an organization that focuses on gun policy, and that's what led us to get involved in this case. We have taken a position that bump stocks are a dangerous attempt, successful up until earlier this week, to circumvent the law, the machine gun statute. And we have urged before Vegas and more energetically since the Las Vegas shooting that these should be treated as the dangerous weapons that they are. You know, so that's where we're coming from. We're coming from a different place, I suppose, than the other two panelists here. You know, I think where we may find some agreement, some commonality, is that, you know, we have urged Congress to pass legislation banning bump stocks, and not just banning bump stocks, but banning a wide range of products that essentially have the same effect as bump stocks in converting semi-automatic weapons to effectively automatic weapons. And so we have supported various bills that have been proposed. We have urged that the best way to deal with this problem or to deal with this issue is for Congress to pass new legislation to clarify once and for all that these devices, these weapons, are not permissible under the law. You know, I think we also agree that one of the benefits to having Congress, in addition to the certainty, and to be clear, one of the reasons why this administrative process is not as desirable as having Congress pass legislation is because we're in a situation now where this rule has taken effect, 72 hours ago, Tuesday at midnight, and so the rule has taken effect, and yet it only kind of has because the plaintiffs represented by the lawyers here on this panel are not subject to the rule yet because it's been stayed as it applies to them, but anybody else, it does apply to them. And, of course, we have the cloud of this ongoing litigation hanging over the rule. So, ask yourself, if you are ATF and you're confronted or comes to your attention that somebody, is in what is now illegal possession of a bump stock, but there's a possibility that, later this afternoon or later this week that rule will be struck down, or sometime in the next couple of weeks that rule will be struck down. Are you going to enforce that rule in an aggressive way, knowing that 2 weeks from now the rule could be struck down, and now you've got somebody that you arrested, you confiscated the property, that's all of a sudden been declared to be legal? And, of course, even if this circuit, D.C. Circuit panel upholds the rule, I certainly wouldn't ask you to tip your hand about your future litigation strategy, but I could imagine a world in which, in one of the cases that we're talking about, that wasn't the end of the story. Whether there was an appeal to the full D.C. Circuit to reconsider the panel decision, assuming the panel upholds the rule, and whether there's an appeal to a petition to the Supreme Court to take the case. So I think we can confidently say that even with this rule having gone into effect for most of the people and most of the country, the final resolution of this litigation is going to be some many months to come, I would expect, and that's not the ideal way to have public policy about an important question of public safety to be put into effect. Now, granted, if Congress passed a new law, we would expect there would be litigation about that too, because a lot of what we do in our litigation side of our work is working to defend whether it's federal, whether it's state, whether it's local gun policy. And our experience is that when we work with policymakers to pass new gun laws, they are quite commonly challenged, and that moves us into the litigation phase of helping to defend the laws that we help to pass. So I'm not suggesting that a congressional legislative approach to this issue would not be subject to litigation, but I think the uncertainty that the litigation casts in this situation is something that that suggests perhaps the congressional legislative route would have been preferable. And I would make one further point on that question, which is to echo what Caleb was talking about democratic accountability. And I would not take issue with the fact that politicians in Congress are able to avoid having to be held accountable for votes on this issue, whether votes for, votes against. I could imagine different constituencies, being unhappy with a vote, whichever way the representative or the senator voted, and I do think an organization like ours, and I'm speaking now as a representative of a 501c3 nonpartisan organization, so I don't mean this in terms of electoral ramifications, but I think having members of Congress cast votes on this and be held accountable on this would be a politically very favorable development from the standpoint of an organization like mine that, that cares about gun policy and public safety. So we may not be coming at this case in terms of the sort of structural, the constitutional democratic structure questions as it might seem at first blush, given that our briefs came into the case advocating different positions. Having said that, the position that we advocated was that the rule should be upheld, and essentially the argument we make in our brief is that just looking at the plain language of the rule, the ATF was right to consider these devices to be machine guns. And I think that does require, with respect to bump stocks, not saying they were wrong for 85 years, saying they were wrong for closer to a dozen years, but that requires taking the position that ATF was wrong when they initially said, no, these aren't covered by the statute. And we believe that that if you just look at the plain language of the statute, I think I'll go back to, and I don't want to misquote Eric, but you know, he sort of demonstrated in talking about what the definition is, the difference between automatic fire and semi-automatic fire. And I think you said with semi-automatic, you pull the trigger once and boom, it fires one shot. You pull it a second time, boom, it fires another. And then you explained automatic fire, which was something like you pull your finger once and it goes boom, 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 boom. Well, I apologize in advance for misquoting you. But I think if you think about that, if you look at that and the way bump stock, a weapon equipped with a bump stock, assuming there's a magazine and there's sufficient ammunition, of course, is that the shooter pulls the finger once, depresses the trigger, and until that person releases the finger, the gun equipped with the bump stock is going to initiate an automatic sequence of firing as many bullets as are there in the magazine or whatever other ammunition feeding device you have until the finger is removed from the trigger. And so at that most basic level, our position is indeed ATF was correct to say that these, like other machine guns that, you know, similarly when the trigger is pulled, depressed, whatever word you want to use, by the finger of the shooter, will initiate an automatic sequence of firing bullets that will continue until the ammunition is gone or the finger is removed from the trigger. So that's the position that we've taken. We're obviously awaiting with great interest, as I suppose everyone here is, to see what this D.C. Circuit panel will do. Candidly, we thought we would have a decision given the expedited briefing and argument schedule before today's, we expected they would rule before Tuesday when the rule took effect. We thought we'd see probably a decision Monday. Obviously, that didn't happen, and we're waiting to see what will happen going forward. So I guess I'll just stop there.
And Eric, I'll give you a chance to respond.
I apologize. I should have saved it. I the advocate in me. I can't help it.
Listen, I'm sure if you misquote me, I'll jump in right
Please
away
do.
As well,
I'd rather have the conversation than make a speech for myself.
So, Eric, why don't, you know, I think you take issue to Adam's characterization of how bump stock works. And I guess I'm curious what you disagree with.
I guess I'll do this as a conversation rather than as anything. So to me, your description of what I said and what I think bump stocks do had a very subtle move that I think the ATF is responsible for, not you personally. You said, till you release the finger, as opposed to till you release the trigger. And that difference is critical, because the ATF doesn't deny that the trigger is released. I don't know that you deny. I don't know that anybody denies that in a bump firing, the trigger literally is released. It separates away from the trigger finger. So the only way one can claim a single anything is by focusing on the finger rather than on the trigger. And the finger, of course, is not on the trigger. It's on this little piece of plastic that doesn't do anything other than hold the finger in place. So you're right if we mean single function of the trigger to mean you move your finger once and that's, and I don't know, something else. That's true. And then the other thing I'd ask is, do you think the fact that you have to push the front of the stock in order to bring the trigger again in contact with your finger matters? Because, of course, if you just rested the stock on a rest and pulled the trigger, it would shoot once and nothing would happen. You could leave your finger there all day. Whereas with the machine gun, you hold that trigger, it keeps shooting no matter where you're. But with bump stocks, it doesn't happen unless you do that. So I'm just curious whether you think those are different phenomena, finger versus trigger, what other input might matter?
I suppose when I said release the finger, what I'm talking about is releasing the finger from the trigger. And, you know, the shooter is not using a bump stock as it is designed and as it functions, assuming it's functioning properly. You know, you pull the... You pull your finger to activate the trigger, and the gun will keep shooting until you remove your finger from the trigger. So that's the position that we think is appropriate, and for that reason, we think the ATF rule should be upheld.
So, do you disagree with the statement that your finger doesn't remain in contact with the trigger?
I would agree that you pull the trigger with your finger and you don't have to make any further contact with the trigger.
Well, but the trigger then separates itself from your finger. It is no longer touching your finger, right, in bump firing. So step one, you pull it. There's recoil. The trigger is now over here. Your finger's over here. You are no longer depressing the trigger with your finger or anything for that matter. Do you disagree with that mechanical description of how it works?
I would disagree with the suggestion that your finger is here and the trigger is here. I think that's...
we have video and the government agrees that that's exactly how bump stock works. So if it's based on the factual assertion that your finger never leaves the trigger, well, that's just wrong. Just as a physical, factual matter. The government doesn't even dispute that. The government agrees that that's true. That's not their argument. They concede that the trigger is separated, physically separated from the finger, resets, and then eventually is bumped back into the finger. Does your interpretation have a different version for that world than for the world where your finger stays on the trigger?
I'm not going to dispute the functioning of how the automatic firing sequence initiated by the pull of the trigger and then accomplished by firing a gun equipped with the bump stock works. I guess where our views would differ is the application of this process the analysis of this process according to the language of the statute.
I agree.
And obviously...
It's just the government has a different theory as to why the statute applies than you do. That's all. I'm not saying that there isn't a path there. It's just their theory is different. Their theory is that the pull initiates a process that may ultimately involve multiple movements of the trigger, but they define function as pull, i.e. function as the action of the shooter, not anything having to do with the physical mechanism that we call the trigger, however one defines the trigger. Whereas your theory seems to depend on the trigger.
Well, I guess where perhaps we're coming from a separate place than you are is it's hard for me to imagine a self-function, a trigger, a single function of the trigger. I suppose you could create a robotic device that would fire a gun as opposed to a human firing a gun. But assuming, and maybe we disagree on this, assuming that you want to look at a gun law as applied to a gun in the context of the assumption that a human being is using the gun, then a single function of the trigger, I think, is something that is going to contemplate a human being firing the gun by pulling the trigger. And so to me, it's not a crazy way to approach that statute by saying a single function of the trigger, a single pull of the trigger, or a push, I suppose, if you were using the gun in a strange way, but a single bringing of pressure to bear on the trigger by the trigger finger, assuming you're using it as the gun is traditionally meant to be used, that is indeed an appropriate way to look at the application of the statutory language to a device that functions in the way that that a device with a bump stock functions. One quick additional point, you know, I very much take your concern that this rule, that this issue, that this analysis could have application beyond just bump stocks themselves. And, you know, our concern is, as I said at the outset, with gun safety. And, you know, there are a variety of devices, I think you said this in your opening remarks, that can change the functioning of a gun that you buy off the shelf at, you know, your local gun store. And, you know, our concern is that a wide range of these devices that are designed and marketed very clearly as an end run around the statute. You know, these are devices that are marketed to shooters on the basis of the law prevents you from getting a machine gun. You know, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. If you buy this product, effectively you can. You can have yourself a machine gun that, you know, we've tried to exploit a technical loophole in the law to be able to claim with a straight face is not a machine gun. And so our concern is with these kinds of devices that we believe enhance the lethality of these guns because they enhance the ability, the speed with which one can fire, you know, multiple rounds very quickly, as again we saw demonstrated in Las Vegas. And so, you know, I think one of the additional advantages to Congress taking this issue up is that they, you know, may be able to pass a statute that looks more holistically at these kinds of devices, as opposed to this ATF process that where the ATF was essentially commanded by the president to issue a rule with respect to bump stocks in particular. You know, I would also both agree with you and disagree with a point that you made earlier, and I think you're probably right. This is a matter of intuition or common sense as opposed to empirical data that I've seen, that somebody who's willing to fire, whether a semi-automatic, an automatic, or otherwise, weapon into a large crowd of people with the intention of killing a large number of people is not going to be dissuaded from using a particular weapon in an illegal manner because of the legality of the weapon. I think we probably can agree on that. I think to go from there to say that, therefore, any legislative or administrative actions along these lines is silly and ineffective, that's where we would take differing paths. And, you know, we hear that, bump stocks is a small part of the overall policy, set of policy issues on which my organization engages and which we advocate for. And we hear that not about only bump stocks, but about pretty much every policy that we advocate, that, you know, criminals don't care about laws. No criminals will follow the laws. These are only going to punish law-abiding citizens and turn them overnight into criminals. And gun laws don't stop criminals, so gun laws are pointless. We needn't do anything about that. And, you know, on the one hand, there's a normative response to that, which is there's plenty of people that speed, but we still have speed limits. Speed limits stop a lot of people from committing illegal acts. We should continue to pass laws even when they're not universally followed. I mean, obviously, we have laws against murder and robbery and burglary, and they don't stop every murder, every robbery, every burglary. But the notion that people continue to break the laws means we shouldn't pass the laws is just one that I have never been convinced by. And I also think that suggesting these won't have an impact is also, it's to me, from a logical standpoint, it's misguided, but it's also empirically proven to be false insofar as you look at different types of gun laws, states that have different types of gun laws, and rates of crime in those states, and there, lo and behold, is a correlation there. And so, you know, the data proves that adopting certain policies is going to increase public safety and protect lives. And, you know, do I believe that as of midnight Tuesday that every owner of a bump stock in the country has, as the law now requires, as the rule requires, has turned those into ATF or destroyed them? No, I'm sure there are thousands, if not tens or even hundreds of thousands of bump stocks that are still out there. Now, maybe some of these people are waiting to see what the courts do and they will turn these in or destroy them subsequently. But I think that, you know, we saw one of the wholesale, or one of the distributors, I should say, of these products on Tuesday turned 60,000 of these devices over to ATF, well, over to a destruction facility under the supervision or, of ATF. And we saw, you know, 60,000 of these devices destroyed the other day. Do I think that, you know, if those had been out in the marketplace and were purchased, that we would have 60,000 people that would commit a mass shooting like Las Vegas? Absolutely not. I think that would be ludicrous. But out of those 60,000 people, or out of the, you know, 500,000 additional bump stocks that are out there, does somebody intent on doing harm have an easier path towards doing so on the type of scale that we saw in Las Vegas? I think the answer to that is yes. So, you know, I certainly wouldn't suggest that getting rid of bump stocks is going to prevent every mass shooting that could be there. And I obviously wouldn't say that getting rid of bump stocks is going to, you know, eliminate gun violence in America. That I think both of those positions would be ludicrous. But do I think there is a benefit to public safety in terms of eliminating the risk of another Las Vegas-style shooting by restricting the supply and the availability of bump stocks? I absolutely do.
So we're going to have to leave that be the last word. I think this was a good discussion.
Thank you.